Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today, we are talking about... Wait, what are we talking about here? I think I may have got the wrong thing open. We're talking about part 2, chapter 23, as read by the lovely Nifterific, and then we will be reading chapter 24. And that's what's happening. Chapter 23. I didn't have any questions because when I posted the thing yesterday, I hadn't read the chapter yet. But that's okay. We got some good discussion. I Am a Norwegian said there's some great psychological depth in this chapter, which I didn't think I'd be able to pull apart in text. I'm more sympathetic to Anna now that I've been more now than I've been so far. She has gotten herself stuck between a rock and a hard place. She is unwilling to bear the consequences of walking in either direction. A part of her understands this. A part of her is warping reality to justify and tear down her husband. Another is unable to confront all of this head on. At least now Vronsky is getting to experience the same frustration Anna's husband suffered when he tried to talk seriously to her. Swim said the mama fish. She said, "Ah, you've captured what was bugging me about Anna." Anna is driving me nuts, says Lexi109. I'm trying to be empathetic because I understand that she's in a precarious position, but I'm struggling. She doesn't want to leave Alexi, but she doesn't want to stay with Alexi, and she won't even talk about it with Vronsky, all of which wouldn't be as big of a deal if she weren't pregnant. The status quo of sneaking around doesn't work anymore. I was also cracking up that both Anna and Vronsky were talking about how honest and trustworthy the other is. Yeah, that's actually a pretty good point, eh? Korsho said, if you're interested in what variant of you is used in the Russian text from the start of the chapter, both Anna and Vronsky use the formal vi. When Anna imitates her husband, she uses vi as well. But starting from I beg you, I entreat you, she suddenly both use the informal ti. Minilial said, I can understand, Anna. If I fell in love with another man, the biggest issue would be, what about my son? And I mean, nowadays, lots of people get divorced, share custodies, etc., but it would definitely be my biggest worry. Back then, it was probably a lot more difficult, especially for women who were financially very dependent on their husbands. Thermos of Beer said, a footnote from P&V, thought of her son. In Russia, before the revolution, divorce was granted by an ecclesiastical court and was very difficult to obtain. Only the injured party could sue for divorce, and only the offending party was denied custody of the children and the right to remarry. Whoa. I Am Norwegian said, it would be my biggest worry also. The research is clear that two parents is better than one. The research clearly shows that being raised by a single parent is associated with all kinds of negative predictors. It's not something most people want to know, though. I was raised by a single mum, although my dad was, you know, very much in the picture. But they got divorced when I was 3 or 2 or something. Seems normal to me. And, yeah, I don't know if I'm weird or not as a result. Maybe I'm weird. Maybe those negative predictors would be like, yep, you might get a weirdo, like this guy. See this guy? And then they just point at me. Maybe. I don't know. But yeah, I know, I would agree. I think, like, yeah. When you talk to someone, and when someone talks to you about their parents, and those people are, like, together, and it's just like, those are your parents in a house, in like that's your family kind of thing, that's your home, I suppose. To me, it just makes me think, even if they're like been bickering for 30 years and they're at each other's throats or whatever, the fact that they're still married and together just makes me think, yeah, that sounds pretty stable. It sounds like it's pretty simple and stable. So I can see why it would be a good kind of foundation for someone to grow up from. Anyway, Format Kakar said, why are they talking in French? Was it like a second language in Russia or something? Yes, it was. The posh Russians spoke French in some cases more so than they spoke Russian. I remember in War and Peace, which is set about 60 years before this book, but still, same place, St. Petersburg and Moscow. The real posh people, some of them don't even speak Russian well, I think, was the case. Or they couldn't write in Russian or something like that. Like, French was so common at that level of society that Russian was more like the peasant language. Weird, hey? Chapter 24 goes like this. When Vronsky looked at his watch on the Karenins' veranda, he was so agitated and so preoccupied that he saw the hands and face of the watch without realizing the time. He went to the high road, stepping carefully over the mud, and made his way to his caliche, made his way to his caliche. He was so full of his feeling for Anna that he did not consider what o'clock it was, or whether he still had time to call on Bryansky. He only retained, as often happens, the external capacity of memory, which indicated that he had decided what he had decided to do next. He approached his coachman, who was dozing on the box, in the already slanting shadow of a large lime tree, looked with pleasure at the swaying swarms of midges that whirled above the perspiring horses, and having roused the coachman, jumped into the caliche and told him to drive to Bryansky's. Only after going some 5 miles did he recollect himself sufficiently to look at his watch and realize that it was already 5:30, and that he was late. There were to be several races that day, a life guards race, then an officers 2-verst race, a 4-verst race, and then the one for which he had entered. He could be in time for his own race, but if he called on Bryansky first, he could only just manage it, and the whole court would already be at the race course. That was not the correct thing to do. But he had promised Bryansky to call, and therefore he decided to go on, telling the coachman not to spare the horses. He saw Bryansky, stayed with him 5 minutes, and drove back at a gallop. This quick drive soothed him. All that was depressing in his relations with Anna, the indefiniteness that remained after their conversation, escaped from his mind. He now thought with enjoyment and agitation of the race, and that after all he would be there in time, and occasionally the expectation of that night's meeting flashed brightly in his imagination. The spirit of the coming races overcame him more and more as he drove further and further into their atmosphere, and overtook carriages making their way to the course from Petersburg and from outlying country places. When he reached his quarters, he found no one there. They had all gone to the races, and his valet was waiting at the gate. While he was changing his things, the valet told him that the second race had already begun, and that many gentlemen had been to inquire for him, and a lad had run over twice from the stables. Having changed without hurrying, he never hurried or lost his self-control, Vronsky ordered the coachman to drive him to the stables. From there he could see the sea of carriages, pedestrians, and soldiers surrounding the racecourse and the stands, which were thronged with people. Probably the second race was just taking place, for as he entered the stables he heard the bell ring. On his way he met Makhotin's white-legged chestnut gladiator, which in a blue-bordered orange covering, with his ears looking enormous in their blue-trimmed cloth, was being led to the course. "Where is Cord?" he asked the groom. "In the stables, saddling." In her open box, Frou Frou stood ready saddled. They were just going to lead her out. "I am not late." All right," answered the Englishman. "Don't upset yourself." Vronsky once again glanced at the beautiful, fascinating shape of the mare, whose whole body was trembling, and tearing himself with difficulty from this sight, he left the shed. He came toward the pavilions at the very best time to avoid attracting anyone's attention. The 2-verst race was nearly over, and all eyes were fixed on an officer of the horse's guards in front and on a hussar officer behind, who were urging their horses to the last limits of their strength as they neared the winning post. From within and without the ring, everyone was crowding toward the winning post, and a group of horse guards, officers, and men, with loud shouts, were expressing their joy at the expected triumph of their officer and comrade. Vronsky joined the crowd unnoticed almost at the moment that the bell rang to announce the end of the race, and the tall officer of the horse guards, all bespattered with mud, who had come in first, was bending down in his saddle, loosening the reins of his grey gelding, which was dark with perspiration and panting heavily. The gelding, planting its feet with effort, reduced the speed of its enormous body, and the guards officer, like one waking from deep sleep, looked around and forced himself to smile. A crowd of friends and strangers surrounded him. Vronsky purposely avoided the select and fashionable crowd, which moved and chattered with restrained freedom in front of the pavilions. He ascertained that Anna, Betsy, and his brother's wife were there, but in order not to agitate himself, intentionally avoided going near them. But he continually met acquaintances who stopped him, told him about the races that had been run, and asked him why he was so late. When the winners were called up to the pavilion to receive their prizes and everyone was looking that way, Vronsky's elder brother Alexander, a colonel with shoulder knots of medium height, as sturdy as Alexis, but handsomer and ruddier, with a red nose and drunken though open countenance, came up to him. "Did you get my note?" he asked. "One can never find you." Alexander Vronsky, despite the loose and in particular drunken life for which he was noted, was quite a courtier. While speaking to his brother of a matter very unpleasant to him, he, knowing that many eyes might be fixed on them, wore a smiling expression as if he were joking with him about some unimportant matter. "I received it, but really do not understand what you are worrying about," replied Alexis. "I am worrying because people have just remarked to me that you were not here and that you were seen in Peterhof last Monday." "There are things which should be discussed only by those who are directly interested, and the matter you are concerning yourself about is one." "Yes, but then one should not be in the army, or I beg you not to interfere, that is all." Alexis Vronsky's frowning face turned pale, and his prominent lower jaw twitched, a thing that rarely happened to him. Being a very kind-hearted man, he seldom got angry, but when he did, and when his chin twitched, then he was dangerous, as Alexander Vronsky knew. Alexander smiled gaily. "I only wanted to deliver mother's letter, answer her, and don't upset yourself before the race. Bon chance," he added, smiling, and went away. "Good luck." But just then another friendly greeting stopped Vronsky. "Won't you recognize your friends?" "How do you do, monsieur?" said Oblonsky, shining here amid all this Petersburg brilliancy, no less than he shone in Moscow, with his rosy face and glistening well-brushed whiskers. "I came yesterday, and I am very glad that I shall witness your triumph. When can we meet?" "Come to the mess room tomorrow," said Vronsky, and apologetically pressing the sleeve of Oblonsky's overcoat, he went to the center of the racecourse where the horses were already being led out for the steeplechase. The perspiring, exhausted horses which had raced were being led away by their grooms, and one by one the fresh ones for the next race were appearing, most of them English horses, which in their hooded coverings and with their tightly girthed stomachs looked like strange gigantic birds. To the right, the slender and beautiful Frou Frou was being led up and down, stepping as on springs with her rather long elastic pasterns. Not far from her they were taking the horse cloth off the big-eared gladiator. The large, beautiful, perfectly regular shape of the horse, with his wonderful hindquarters and his exceptionally short pasterns just above his hoofs, involuntarily arrested Vronsky's attention. He wished to go up to his own horse, but was again stopped by an acquaintance. "Ah, there is Karenin," said the acquaintance with whom he was talking. "He is looking for his wife, and she is in the center of the pavilion. Have you not seen her?" "No, I have not," said Vronsky, and without even glancing at the pavilion where Anna was pointed out to him, he went to his horse. He had not had time to examine the saddle, about which he wished to give some directions, when the riders were summoned to the pavilion to draw the numbers and places. With serious, stern, and in many cases pale faces, 17 officers assembled at the pavilion and drew their numbers. Vronsky got number 7, the order was given, "Mount." Feeling that he and the other riders were the centre toward which all eyes were turned, Vronsky, in the highly strung state which generally made his movements calm and deliberate, approached his horse. Cord, in honour of the races, was dressed in his best clothes, a black buttoned-up coat, a stiff, stretched, starched collar that pressed against his cheeks, a bowler hat, and top boots. He was calm and important as usual, and standing in front of the horse was himself holding both its reins. Frou-Frou continued to tremble as if in a fever. Her fiery eyes turned on the approaching Vronsky. Vronsky pushed his fingers under the girths. The mare turned her eyes still further back, showed her teeth, and set back an ear. The Englishman puckered his lip, wishing to express a smile at anyone testing his saddling. "You'd better mount. You will be less excited." Vronsky glanced round at his rivals for the last time. He knew that he would not see them during the race. Two of them were already riding towards the starting point. Galstin, one of the formidable competitors and a friend of Vronsky's, was struggling with a sorrel gelding that would not let him mount. A short hussar in tight riding breeches was galloping along, bunched up like a cat in his desire to imitate an English jockey. Prince Kusilovlev sat pale-faced on his thoroughbred mare from the Grabov stud farm, which an Englishman was leading by the bridle. Vronsky and all his set knew Kusilovlev and his peculiarities, which were weak nerves and terrible vanity. They knew he was afraid of everything, even of riding an army horse. But now, just because it was dangerous, because necks might be broken, and at each obstacle there was a doctor in attendance, an ambulance wagon with a red cross sewn on it, and a nurse, he had determined to ride. Their eyes met, and Vronsky winked at him kindly and approvingly. The only one Vronsky did not see was his chief rival, Makhotin, on his gladiator. "Don't hurry," said Cord to Vronsky, "and remember one thing, do not hold back or urge on your horse at any obstacle, let her have her way." Very well," said Vronsky, taking the reins. "Lead if you can, but do not despair till the last moment if you are behind." The mare had not time to stir before Vronsky, with a powerful and agile movement, put his foot in the notches, steel stirrup, and seated himself lightly but firmly on the creaking leather of the saddle. Having got his right foot also in its stirrup, he straightened out the double reins between his practiced fingers, and Cord removed his hand, as if not knowing which foot to step up on first. Frou-Frou stretched the reins with her long neck and started, as if on springs, shaking her rider on her flexible back. Cord, quickening his steps, followed them. The restive horse tugged at the reins, now to one side, now to the other, trying to deceive her rider, and Vronsky vainly sought by voice and hand to soothe her. They were already approaching the dammed up stream on their way to the starting post. Some of the riders were in front, some behind, when Vronsky suddenly heard a horse galloping through the mud behind him, and Makhotin on his white-legged, large-eared gladiator went past him. Makhotin smiled, showing his long teeth, but Vronsky looked at him angrily. Vronsky always disliked him, and now considered him his most dangerous rival, and he was vexed with him for galloping past and so exciting Frou-Frou. She broke into a canter, gave two leaps, and, angry at the tightened rein, changed back into a jerky trot, jolting her rider. Cord also frowned, following Vronsky almost at a run. All right. There we go, another chapter down. Horse business. Horse things are happening. Looks like we're about to get a race. That's pretty exciting. I didn't expect a high-speed race chase in this book. Could be a bit of fun. I wonder if it'll be anything like Fast and Furious. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.